It's Wednesday, June 17. Today, we're looking at why European leaders are sweating over the G7, the weirdly high-stakes intersection of AI infrastructure and the coming IPO rush, and why the betting markets at Royal Ascot are essentially a trap for the lazy. We're also looking at the slow-motion collapse of our shared reality, from the news cycle to the history books. Here's the thing, we've got a lot of ground to cover. European leaders are hunkering down at the G7, and the mood is, to put it mildly, anxious. They're trying to build a unified front to manage Donald Trump, specifically to stop him from cutting a solo lopsided peace deal with Russia. The fear is that Trump's transactional view of diplomacy will lead him to trade Ukrainian sovereignty for a quick win, which would leave Europe staring down a permanent Russian military presence on its doorstep. Here's the thing. The leverage here is tied to a $14 trillion U.S.-Ukraine reconstruction investment fund. Trump is clearly interested in the money, but there's a catch. Over half of the mineral reserves tied to that fund are currently sitting in Russian-occupied territory. That means for Trump to actually cash in, the fighting has to stop, and he needs those lands to be accessible. It's a direct link between his personal commercial interests and his push for a settlement. Zelensky is trying to play this by positioning Trump as the only mediator who can get things done, which has helped him secure military hardware like Patriot missiles. But make no mistake, the stalemate on the ground is now being overlaid by a high-stakes private sector-style negotiation. Europe knows that if they don't keep Trump on a leash, they're the ones who will be left footing the bill for a destabilized continent. It's a shitty situation when the security of a continent depends on whether a president is more interested in mineral rights than regional stability. Moving to the Middle East, the US and Iran have entered into a 60-day window, described by analysts as a framework for a de-escalation agreement. On the surface, the State Department is calling this a win. But underneath the diplomatic paperwork, there's a much darker trend taking hold: the normalization of nuclear coercion. We're seeing a world where nuclear threats are being used as a standard tool for enforcement, which effectively trash cans 80 years of non-proliferation norms. If the international community says, fine, using nukes as a threat is just how we do business now, then every mid-sized power, think Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Japan, is going to conclude that they need their own deterrent to stay alive. The logic being used here is strategically incoherent. The idea is that a single tactical strike could force an opponent to fold. But if they don't fold, you're left with a binary trap. You either back down and look weak, or you escalate to a second strike. It's a gateway to an uncontrollable cascade. And there's a secondary, colder motive here. The U.S. might be using this pressure to deny China access to the South Pars gas field. When we start using nuclear weapons as instruments of resource spite, we've crossed a line that's hard to uncross. We're living in a time where the fear infrastructure of the Cold War is gone, and the current generation of leaders seems to think they can play these games without the whole thing blowing up. If we don't challenge this in the next 2 months, this ceasefire won't be a pause. It'll be the moment we stopped caring about the nuclear taboo entirely. Switching gears to the state of our political discourse, today marks the 10th anniversary of the murder of MP Joe Cox. Instead of a turning point for civility, we've seen the total collapse of our shared reality. We're trapped in an algorithmic feedback loop where outrage is the only currency that matters. Media figures and politicians aren't rewarded for being right. They're rewarded for confirming the biases of their specific tribe. It's turned political opposition into something existential. If you disagree with me, you're not just wrong, you're an enemy of my way of life. This is being weaponized, and foreign actors, specifically Russia, are loving it. They're using low-level protectors to pour gasoline on community tensions, targeting both far-right and anti-Muslim groups simultaneously to ensure the political center is completely hollowed out. Meanwhile, our institutions are so busy playing whack-a-mole with conspiracy theories that they don't have the bandwidth to actually govern or address things like defense spending or labor market shifts. We're stuck in a cycle of reactive short-term politics because the system now actively punishes any politician who tries to be honest about the trade-offs we actually face. This epistemological uncertainty is mirrored in our digital infrastructure. The discovery of the Fast16 malware shows that the game has shifted from stealing data to manipulating reality itself. This malware doesn't just crash systems, it silently corrupts the math inside physics simulations. It's a psychological weapon. It forces researchers to doubt their own competence. They look at the numbers, they know the formulas are right, but the output is wrong. They start wondering if they're going crazy. It's a brilliant, if horrifying, way to stall nuclear programs without ever firing a shot. It erodes trust in the very tools we use to understand the world. If we can't trust the basic computations of our critical infrastructure, we're essentially living in a permanent state of uncertainty. And, while we're on the subject of history, we're seeing a massive coordinated effort to rewrite it ahead of the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Historians David Blight and Annette Gordon-Reed have pointed out that we're currently in a tug-of-war between two narratives. One is a complex, honest look at the American experiment. The other is a sanitized, nostalgic myth tied to Christian nationalism. This isn't just an academic debate. It's a strategy to delegitimize modern social equity movements. By framing the acknowledgement of historical injustices as an attack on national identity, ideologues are trying to shield the current social order from having to take any responsibility for the past. It's a way of saying, if the past was perfect, then the present is just meritocracy, which honestly is a hell of a way to justify status quo inequality. Finally, a quick look at the Strait of Hormuz. Everyone's talking about the peace deal reopening the shipping lanes, but the maritime industry is staying cautious. You can sign all the memos you want, but shipping companies won't send their vessels through a channel that might still be littered with sea mines. It's going to take weeks of verification. And beyond that, the vulnerability of the strait has already changed the math for oil-producing nations. They're looking at long-term alternatives, like pipelines, to bypass the strait entirely because they realize it's a massive strategic liability. And in the culture war, the LGBTQ rights movement is finding out the hard way that progress isn't a one-way street. After marriage equality, a lot of people stepped back, thinking the war was won. It wasn't. Opposition groups have strategically pivoted to anti-trans rhetoric to divide the public, and they're winning in some areas. 9 states have moved to undermine marriage equality, and a huge chunk of Fortune 500 companies have pulled back from their corporate advocacy. It's a reminder that rights built on fragile legal precedents, rather than comprehensive federal law, can be pulled out from under you the second the political winds change. It's a lot to take in, I know, but it's the reality we're operating in, where the lines between digital manipulation, historical memory, and physical conflict are blurrier than they've ever been. Regarding the tech landscape, the AI sector is currently caught in a massive structural pivot, moving away from the move fast and break things era toward what looks like a high-stakes coordination game. First, the competitive landscape is shifting from software to raw, physical infrastructure. We're seeing a clear trend of vertical integration. Google is investing heavily in compute capacity, while the Bezos-backed firm Prometheus has closed a $12 billion raise. The takeaway here is that the real edge isn't just in the code anymore, it's in who controls the energy and the physical hardware to actually run these models. Which honestly, sounds like the prelude to a very expensive sci-fi novel. Meanwhile, the industry is entering an informal IPO race. OpenAI, Anthropic, and SpaceX are all positioning for public markets, but that creates a shitty situation for their internal controls. These labs want total authority over their systems to manage risks like recursive self-improvement. Yet they're facing pressure to move toward the transparency required by public scrutiny. There's even talk of government equity stakes, which would trade that private autonomy for state-sanctioned legitimacy. That's a massive gamble for companies that until now have operated like independent fiefdoms. In terms of actual capability, Anthropic has released new model iterations that show significant gains in coding and complex tasks. But this comes with a catch. The lab has implemented strict, often hidden guardrails to block the use of their tools for bioweapons or cyber attacks. It's a direct conflict between the desire to make these models smarter and the need to keep them from being used for catastrophic ends. This tension is bleeding into the broader economy too. Right now, AI infrastructure is driving about 75% of recent GDP gains, but there's a massive disconnect happening. Businesses are hitting budget walls and tightening their belts, while labs are desperate for them to burn through more tokens to justify their massive spending. Companies like Uber and Walmart are already looking for cheaper, open-source alternatives to cut costs. This is creating what's being called a known ROI bias, where firms are using AI for piddling tasks like meeting summaries instead of the high-risk, high-reward stuff that actually creates value. If businesses don't figure out how to manage these systems as reasoning partners rather than just fancy chatbots, the whole economic growth story for AI is going to stall out. And then there's the shift towards super apps. The industry is moving away from simple chat interfaces to systems that can autonomously read, write, and execute tasks across your browser and local files. OpenAI's Codex is leading the charge here with a unified interface that combines chat, automation, and live browsing. But this brings up a massive operational risk. When you give an agent read and write access to your local environment, you're basically removing the human safety buffer. Without strict sandboxing, we're looking at a future where the speed of execution is faster than any human's ability to catch a catastrophic error. Finally, we're hitting a wall with the current architecture. Large language models are essentially probability engines. They're built to predict the next word, not to tell the truth. They've been optimized to be fluent, which often just means they're really good at being sycophantic. In fields like medicine or banking, that's a liability. We're seeing a growing consensus that the industry needs to move away from these end-to-end black boxes and towards systems that favor verifiability, clear information provenance, and structured decision trees. The bottom line is that the bottleneck for AI isn't technical capacity anymore. It's human capability and design integrity. Organizations that treat AI training as a core strategic investment and prioritize reliability over simple, confident-sounding output are the ones likely to survive this transition. Everyone else is just building systems that are one reward hacking error away from a total crash. Anyway, it's going to be a long year for the engineers. Speaking of games, the Royal Ascot midweek races are officially underway, and if you're looking at the past performance charts to pick a favorite, you're likely setting your money on fire. The reality of this track is that raw speed matters a hell of a lot less than where a horse is standing in the gate, and how much they hate the geometry of the course. In races like the Queen's Vase, the track layout is a nightmare for anyone drawn in double digits. The distance to the first turn is so short that if you aren't drawn between 1 and 5, you're basically running a lost cause before the race even starts. The Queen's Vase is a masterclass in how track geography beats talent every single time. It's the same story with the Royal Hunt Cup, where the field effectively splits in two due to the rail position. If your horse ends up on the wrong side of that split, their form doesn't mean a damn thing. The betting market consistently fails to account for this, which means the value isn't in finding the fastest horse. It's in finding the one that got screwed by the draw last time out and is now priced like a loser. Trainers like William Haggas aren't showing their hand early. They're using the start of the season to manipulate handicap marks, intentionally keeping a horse's form looking mediocre so they can hit a specific target weight for the Ascot meeting. When you see a plot horse that looks underwhelming on paper, that's usually a calculated move, not a fluke. The Prince of Wales Stakes is the ultimate example of this. It's a Group 1 event, and a win and you are in qualifier for the Breeders' Cup. But the top contenders are often separated by only a pound or two in official ratings. At that level, the race is won by the horse that actually likes the punishing Ascot topography. The straight mile and the stiff sprints there are brutal, and they favor battle-hardened veterans over young, lightly raced prospects every time. Look, the takeaway here is pretty straightforward. The market loves a favorite, but the market is also lazy. It ignores the structural inefficiencies of the track itself. If a horse has proven they can navigate the specific, weird, and frankly punishing layout of Ascot, they're a better bet than the high-rated horse that's never set foot on the course. It's a game of geometry and pedigree, not just speed. If you're betting, you're better off looking for each-way value to cover the massive chaotic fields than chasing the short-priced runner that's being pushed by the public. Any way you slice it, the favorites at Ascot are usually the ones making the bookies the happiest. Shifting to the business of sports, Fox Corporation is officially moving from a content company to a landlord. They're buying Roku, a massive bet that in the streaming era, the person who owns the remote or the interface is the one who actually holds the power. By controlling the gateway to 100 million households, Fox isn't just looking to host its own channels. It's positioning itself to collect a cut of every subscription and ad sold through the platform. It's a smart, if cold, pivot. Cable is dying, and trying to win the streaming wars by just making better shows is a hell of a gamble. Instead, Fox is taking the position of the house. They'll be the ones gatekeeping content, which puts them in a pretty aggressive spot with the NFL and other streamers. If you're a content provider, you're now at the mercy of the platform owner's UI. And let's be real, Fox wasn't exactly known for being a neutral party before this. Speaking of consolidation, we're seeing a similar squeeze in Hollywood. The old days of actors and writers banking on long-term residuals are basically gone. Streaming platforms have effectively killed the back-end model, replacing it with big upfront fees and performance bonuses. It's a transition from a career-based business to an entrepreneurial one, where talent is now forced to act like a startup. You're not just a performer, you're a content creator who has to build your own audience to maintain any kind of leverage. If you aren't your own distribution channel, you're just waiting for a platform to decide if you're worth the cost of production. Meanwhile, in collegiate sports, things are getting messier. We've got Michigan State signing a department-wide jersey patch deal with a credit union, which is a perfect example of programs scraping for every dollar they can find. But the administrative side is cracking. You have guys like Tom Izzo essentially calling out his own board of trustees. It's a classic case of institutional instability, where politically motivated boards are clashing with the people who actually run the programs. When the people in the boardroom care more about power plays than leadership continuity, it's only a matter of time before the donors and the coaches start looking for the exit. And finally, a note on the betting boom. It's easy to look at the scandals and the ads and think of it as some outside force, but it's actually the industry's native business model. It's how sports turned into high-stakes entertainment in the first place. But the second-order effects are hitting hard, especially with athletes. We're seeing increased reports of abuse directed at Division I men's basketball players from bettors. The industry keeps chasing engagement metrics, but they're ignoring the fact that they're normalizing a level of risk and harassment that might eventually hollow out the product itself. When the game is just a vehicle for a parlay, you're eventually going to run out of fans who actually care about the team. Turning to the broader economy, the Reserve Bank of Australia has officially kept interest rates at 4.35%. They're effectively hitting the pause button, waiting to see how the previous string of hikes actually impacts what people are spending at the grocery store and on their mortgages. Here's the catch. Inflation is currently sitting at 4.2%. That is well above their stated target of 2-3%. Because things like global supply chain snarls and the cost of fuel aren't budging, the current outlook suggests we aren't looking at rate cuts anytime soon. That is a hell of a long time to keep the screws tightened. The government is facing a bit of a localized crisis next week regarding fuel excise relief. If they decide to reinstate the full excise on July 1, it's going to act like an accelerant on inflation. If that happens, we are looking at a short-term shock that forces the Reserve Bank to keep rates higher for even longer than the market has priced in. It's a classic pick-your-poison scenario. Either the government keeps subsidizing costs, or they let the inflation spike hit the household budget directly. Meanwhile, the way we consume information is undergoing a pretty seismic shift. Interest in news is growing among younger demographics and women, but these groups have effectively abandoned legacy media. A significant majority of people between the ages of 18 and 24 are now getting their news from influencers rather than newspapers, television, or radio. We are seeing a hard pivot toward decentralized, algorithmic content. Journalism is being swapped out for whatever a creator or an AI chatbot decides to feed the feed. It's not just a drop in subscriptions for the old guard, it's a total loss of editorial oversight. When your primary news source is an algorithm optimized for engagement rather than accuracy, the entire information ecosystem becomes inherently volatile. It's hard to build a consensus on anything, including economic policy, when the public isn't even looking at the same set of facts. These two things, the economic stagnation and the media fragmentation, are hitting at the same time. You've got a central bank trying to manage an economy that's addicted to cheap credit, and you've got an electorate that's getting its reality via curated clips and bots, which honestly is a shitty recipe for stability. We are moving into a future where the cost of living feels permanent and the truth feels optional. Policymakers are going to have to figure out how to govern when the levers of economic control are limited by inflation, while the traditional channels for explaining those decisions to the public have essentially evaporated. It's not just that the systems are broken, it's that the systems are becoming increasingly decentralized to the point where they might not even be systems anymore. Just a collection of high interest rates and fragmented, algorithmically driven noise. Anyway, don't expect the math to get easier anytime soon. On a personal level, the Rethink Academy is pushing a new model for workplace productivity, moving away from theory-heavy training toward what they call the professionalization of work study. They're using digital tools to automate data collection, which they say gives analysts more time to actually observe processes. The end goal here is to move companies from top-down arbitrary budgeting to a bottom-up model, allowing leadership to test the impact of small process changes before they commit to anything permanent. It sounds like a fancy way of saying, measure twice, cut once. But the emphasis on getting buy-in from unions and operators suggests they've dealt with enough failed initiatives to know that the human element is usually where the wheels fall off. Meanwhile, research into the getting things done methodology points to a 20% increase in throughput for aerospace teams that strictly defined next actions for every commitment. The logic is that when you keep tasks in your head, you're creating a mental tax that slows you down. By dumping those tasks into a system, you force yourself to either execute, delegate, or kill the task entirely. It's essentially an outsourcing of your executive function to a notepad. Finally, there's a new look at what's being called the curse of the white rabbit, the tendency for high achievers to tie their self-worth to ever-moving external goals. The theory is that when you treat success as a destination, your brain just shifts the goalposts the second you arrive, which honestly isn't news to anyone who's ever hit a milestone and felt nothing. The argument here is that you're actually more effective when you decouple your internal state from those benchmarks. If you stop trying to fix an internal void with a balance sheet, you might actually get more done. Or at the very least, you'll be less miserable while you're doing it. And a few other things worth knowing this morning. First, if you're still buying separate travel insurance for every trip, you're probably just donating money to the insurance company. If you're using a premium card, you've already got primary travel protection baked in. Just make sure you actually put the trip on the card. Next, a sobering reminder that our bodies are pretty poorly engineered for the modern world. We're wired to panic when carbon dioxide builds up, but we have absolutely no internal alarm for oxygen deprivation. In a nitrogen-rich environment, you'll just lose consciousness without a single warning sign, which is a hell of a design flaw. On the aviation front, sustainable aviation fuel is currently stuck in a classic chicken and egg nightmare. It's too expensive to scale, but it's too expensive because there's no supply chain, and until someone breaks that cycle, we're stuck burning the same old dinosaur juice. And finally, for the basketball nerds, NBA front offices have finally figured out that the draft is mostly a crapshoot after the first few picks. The talent pool is concentrated at the top and the very start of the second round, so teams are shifting their focus to just finding reliable rotation players instead of chasing ghosts of superstars that aren't there. That's the briefing for today. Keep your head on a swivel, and I'll see you tomorrow.